The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, I'm Alex Krotowski. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. As regular as Christmas and New Year itself, the season also brings with it the Tech Weekly Review of the Year. In this week's program, we'll run through the last 12 months in social media, mobile, games, and anything that slightly smells of technology. Here with me to look back at 2011's highs and lows is The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur, and TechCrunch Europe's editor, Mike Butcher. Welcome both to the studio.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Gentlemen, which technology do you think will fail first because of the snow this year?
The drivers of snowplows cars.
That would suck.
Are trains a technology?
Yeah, absolutely.
After a fashion. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it is the wrong kind of snow. I prefer my snow warm and invisible.
So, not at all.
So, yes.
Warm and invisible. A light rain, perhaps. Well, let's get on with it, because we've got a jam-packed program today. A reminder that you can tweet along with the program and tell us your thoughts on our selections of 2011's tech highlights, as well as what you thought we missed out. Our Twitter handle is @GuardianTW, and do use the hashtag #Tech2011. We'll be retweeting them over the festive period. So, ready? Strapped in? Ready to go? This is Tech Weekly 2011 from The Guardian. We begin the program with the sounds of some of the revolutionary change that's taken place around the world this year. Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Syria, as well as riots on the streets of London and the Occupy movements, have all been part of a year of protest and demonstration, so much so that this week Time magazine named the protester their person of the year. The uprisings and movements have been attributed to the ability to gather and organize through social media, so much so that in Egypt the government cut off the country from the internet, which was, of course, strongly criticized by the U.S.
The people of Egypt have rights that are universal. That includes the right to peaceful assembly and association, the right to free speech, and the ability to determine their own destiny. These are human rights, and the United States will stand up for them everywhere. I also call upon the Egyptian government to reverse the actions that they've taken to interfere with access to the internet, to cell phone service, and to social networks that do so much to connect people in the 21st century.
President Barack Obama there back in January 2011. But was the power of this change really down to social media? And could the use of Facebook and Twitter, mobile phones and BBM actually incriminate protesters? Well, here's Evgeny Morozov from Tech Weekly back in January.
You can use, you know, Facebook and Twitter and any other tools to mobilize people to do something that they wouldn't do otherwise. The question is whether that actually happened in Tunisia is an open one, whether any of the same people would actually show up as angry as they were if there wasn't Twitter or Facebook. I probably assume that social media did help to mobilize some people. I also think that it did play an important role in terms of highlighting what was going on and then transmitting it to some of the global media like Al Jazeera. So all of that definitely is happening. I mean, my point is that, you know, if you want to understand the importance of the internet in democratization, we have to look beyond just its impact on protest and mobilization. And Belarus actually is a very good example of how, new media and technology and mobile phones can actually be used against activists. So now there are some reports that after the protests following the presidential elections on December 19th, the government may actually be asking mobile operators for any data that they have on their subscribers to track down everyone who was present in the public square where the protests were happening. If the protests in Tunisia didn't succeed, chances are Ben Ali would now be going through Facebook and Twitter messages and all the mobile networks trying to figure out who was it that actually tried to, you know, protest against him, as actually happened in Iran.
Evgeny Morozov, whose predictions came true when BlackBerry makers RIM said that they would cooperate with the police to track down people who posted inflammatory messages about the UK riots in August. And if you want to hear that interview again or any other program from the Tech Weekly archive that we mentioned this week, you can find the links to the programs on the program page or on your iPod screen now. So, social media, a force for good, ill, or otherwise. Mike, to what extent was social media really part of it all?
Well, I think Facebook became a kind of organizing method. You've got to remember that in Africa, that Facebook's strategy was to have virtually free access to Facebook on the mobile. And in a way, it was cheaper to use Facebook than it was to send text messages. You don't want to kind of overemphasize the role of Facebook. And, of course, you know, there was lots of other kinds of ways of organizing, such as word of mouth.
Yeah, but, or for example, Charles, things like, you know, passing out flyers or even some of the other social, or not social media, but even some of the other internet-enabled things like Ushahidi. You know, to what extent were those as important? And over here, we just got excited because we recognized the names Twitter and Facebook, Charles.
Exactly. Mm.
It's difficult because, I mean, you know, flyers and so on, that requires printing. And it's if you're caught with a whole lot of flyers on you by someone who's acting for the government, then that's not good news for you. I suspect that when we look back on it, we'll find that social media had an important part in managing to bring lots of small networks together into larger networks in the Arab Spring protests especially. And actually, you know, the same is demonstrated, I think, in the UK riots analysis by London University and The Guardian, that the thing about social media isn't that it sort of organises everything together, but that you have lots of small enclaves and it can hop across them. You get people who are, in effect, sort of spreaders of the news, and they cross different networks, and that's how it gains momentum.
And especially also we saw how social platforms were enabled to get the word out to the wider mainstream media, who would then sort of reflect back onto things, and then something would happen again on the ground, as it were. And that was a very interesting thing that happened.
It is, because ultimately what it turns into is not just a galvanizing or organizing technology like a mobile phone or again, a printing press, but also this way of publicizing. It becomes a PR mechanic. And certainly we've seen that with something like the Occupy movement. But Charles, actually going back to what you were saying about people with flyers, you know, doesn't look very good if you're apprehended by the government. You still have a digital footprint if you're posting on Twitter or Facebook, and if you are creating messages that, you know, try, for example, as we saw in the UK during the London riots, saying, you know, let's have a riot today, let's meet up at this pub, that has implications as well for the individuals who took part.
It does. I mean, there's no doubt about that. Although in certain countries it might be easier just to buy, say, a prepaid phone. You could give a fake name and address. You can use the prepaid phone to, you know, contact people, organize in that sort of way. So you can create new digital footprints which don't lead anywhere. I think that that's slightly easier to organise, possibly using, you know, prepaid BlackBerries and things.
Absolutely. We also saw the rise of the BlackBerry BBM as almost like a little printing press that could to distribute information. I'm reminded of the immortal words of one that was printed widely in media: "The dead, the ends, and colour war for now. If you see a brother, salute. If you see a fed, shoot." And it was an amazing BBM that just got sent all around. And I don't even know if anybody knows who actually came up with it.
Well, BBM in particular was interesting because while what we saw in Egypt was a top-down government attempt to shut down a network that is impossible to shut down, as we saw, in the UK, Mike, we saw the UK government trying to shut down BBM. It demonstrates a lot of what Evgeny was talking about, his claims, and how governments are reacting to these systems.
Well, yeah, they certainly wanted to not shut it down, but certainly David Cameron, the Prime Minister, called in Facebook and Twitter and BlackBerry to to actually sort of discuss what should happen in similar scenarios.
Charles?
I think it's just very interesting, just going back to the Arab Spring issue, how important YouTube has been for letting people see what's going on in Syria.
Well, staying with protests and direct action, 77 million users were affected when Sony's PlayStation Network was taken offline in April. Soon after, it transpired that user data had been accessed by hackers, and it took more than 6 weeks for the service to come back online. Ouch! Leaving Sony with a $170 million bill for the episode. It was suggested that the hacking franchise Anonymous was responsible for the Sony attack after they decided to prosecute 22-year-old George Hotz, who reverse-engineered the PS3. It wasn't Anonymous's only action this year, as it was suggested that they were responsible for DDoS attacks on the websites of Tunisian and Egyptian governments and hacks on the email system of security firm HB Gary, amongst others. The British government certainly took the threat seriously.
This age of digitized public services creates challenges as well as opportunities. There's the challenge of ensuring the security of personal data and financial information, for example. The hacking into Sony's online PlayStation network, the theft of millions of users' credit card details, is a high-profile example of the need for robust online security. This applies equally to government as to the private sector. In any given month, there are over 20,000 malicious emails sent to government networks. And here is a salient story from the year that I've been Chancellor. We have seen, during the last year, hostile intelligence agencies make hundreds of serious and pre-planned attempts to break into the Treasury's computer system. In fact, it averaged out at more than one attempt per day.
Chancellor George Osborne at the Google Zeitgeist Conference in May. And in November, Cabinet Office Minister Francis Maude announced that the intelligence agency GCHQ would be working with companies like Barclays, BT, and Vodafone to prevent cybercrime. Charles, is this the year that cybercrime has been taken seriously?
I think it's the year when it's actually had the equivalent of a sort of nuclear bomb going off. So 77 million users being hit on the PSN by whoever carried out this hack, which is not absolutely pinned to Anonymous, and Sony still hasn't said who, though I've been asking them repeatedly through the year. That's a lot of people all at once. There have been sort of cybercrime episodes going on, you know, here and there against banks, against individual users through credit cards. But that's sort of been like, little incidents around here and there. But the PSN hack was such a big thing that it really caught people's notice. And that got people thinking about the whole issue of how widely is cybercrime, cyber attacks, the Chinese attacks on Google and Google Mail and on the Free Tibet movement, and similarly the Chinese attacks that have been going on against Western governments, and the attacks by Israel and the US on Iran's nuclear facility through Stuxnet. So it made everyone more aware of it.
In the UK this year, Mike, we had the cybersecurity conference and certainly got a lot of attention from the frontbenchers. Are the responses, do you think, of the government in this country as well as governments globally the correct ones? They say that, within 2 years they're going to create a cybercrime unit within the National Crime Agency. They're sending guidelines to courts and police highlighting the extra powers that those organizations have available. Is this the right approach to curb some of this cyber activity?
It's interesting how it's pulling in both ways. Both governments are engaging in this, as with I think what we saw with Stuxnet, and both at the other end of the scale, people like Anonymous. But the UK government is quite clearly recognising that this is going to be a major issue going forward. Of course, it will never get around the lost laptop of some government minister, which it will probably continue to happen quite frequently. And it's interesting to see the proliferation of things like tablets now in the Houses of Parliament. Everything's going digital, so it is going to be a major issue.
Charles, what do you think motivates somebody to become a cyber criminal? You've spent a lot of time speaking with some of the people in Anonymous. I recall your phone number was published on...
That was interesting.
Yeah. Was it on Anonymous or was it LulzSec?
No, it was LulzSec.
Yeah, I mean, you spent a lot of time speaking with some of the groups that have fractured off the central Anonymous franchise and also with Anonymous themselves. What do you see as their motivations, and what do you see as as what they intend to do moving forward?
Well, I mean, yeah, let's clarify. A lot of the people who associate with Anonymous are not cyber criminals, wouldn't think of themselves that way, and it wouldn't be fair in any way to class them like that. I mean, when I think about cyber criminals, I'm thinking generally about people who are trying to get monetary gain, or else people working for governments who are trying to get political, economic, intellectual property sort of gain. And those are two groups who are really hard to track. But, you know, the motivation is simple. You know, it's either monetary or it's political.
Well, let's move on to the year's other big tech story, and it is a sadder one.
Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
He was lucky to have me in the beginning, but I am much, you know, incredibly lucky to him for everything in my life. He gets a reputation for being a strong leader and being brash, but to me, he was just always so kind, such a good friend, and I'm just going to miss him.
Steve Wozniak there on his former co-founder of Apple, Steve Jobs, and the man himself in his famous Stanford address from 2005. We won't dwell too long on his death, as there's a lot has been said already on this. But Charles, a sad end to the Steve Jobs story. He clearly made plans because he stepped down as CEO and various other things.
Yeah, I'm not sure he was actually at Apple that much in the final year. He took the medical leave in January, and then he was having a lot of really quite advanced treatment. They were doing things like they were mapping out the genome of the cancer and trying to do therapy-specific gene targeting on that, which is, you know, pretty cutting-edge stuff, which I think is part of why he survived so long, actually, because I spoke to a cancer specialist back in the beginning of the year who said, yeah, well, I give it about 6 months, to be honest. And the fact that he was still going and that he died after 10 months is indicative of how good the care was. But I have to say, I think that it's it's a really, what can you say? It sounds unkind, but it was his own fault. He's a man who's at the top of a company which is all about engineering and science and technology and understanding how to do these things. And he was about understanding and control. And yet, when it came to a simple medical diagnosis, where he was told, have some treatment this is completely curable, or, you know, has a very high chance of being cured, he delayed from the October until the July. And that's probably what killed him.
Have you read the autobiography, Mike?
I've tried to get into it, absolutely. But
It's a beast.
It's a beast, yes. It's a big one, it's probably one of the most in-depth biographies that anyone's ever written about anybody, in fact. But he was a very unusual man, a very unusual individual. I mean, his lasting impact on the world of technology will be, you know, with us for a long time. I mean, if you can think about where we are now compared to even a few years ago with interface and the proliferation of apps. And he's changed entire industries, both in the computing and the mobile phone. And, I mean, the world will be completely different as a result of Steve Jobs.
Well, what's going to happen now, Charles? His legacy, you know, the systems that he set into place, you know, putting Tim Cook in at the top slot, for example. Well, what do we expect from this organization?
Cook is fantastic at the functioning and the detail of it. As I understand it, Phil Schiller, who's the marketing chief, is very good at the sort of the broader picture of the where should they go. The interesting question is strategy and the inspiration and the saying no to things and choosing what you say yes to, you know, which is always the difficulty. I mean, that was the thing at Sony, which moved from being a company which was just derided after the war, to being one which was a behemoth and which came up with things like the Walkman. And then after the death of Akio Morita, has really floundered and tried to find its way. I think that Apple is actually the most stable of these big companies at the moment. I think it has the fewest things to worry about in the short term. How long it goes in the longer term, anyone's guess.
Okay, well, moving on to the rest of the year for Apple, there were two hugely successful launches, Mike, the iPad 2 and the 4S, which was the 4S itself was about 4 or 5 months later than had been expected. Yeah. But both record sales, launch of the new operating system with Lion and iOS 5, voice activation service Siri, storage service iCloud. I mean, it's yeah. remarkable how much they launched. The software download service for the Mac App Store and cloud-based music storage service iTunes Match, which launched in America, which we are anticipating.
Looks like it's just launched in the UK. Okay. Yeah.
So it's a very, very significant year for Apple's product launches. What would you say of those, that long list, what would you say is the most significant?
I think Siri is going to be amazing. Maybe that's an odd choice, perhaps, but if you see that Apple's strategy moving towards the television, you can see that Siri is going to be a potential component of an Apple TV, if you like. You've already seen that, in fact, the Xbox has now got a voice-activated command, but it's not really working. You can see that Apple using Siri gradually in the home, you know, getting in, you know, Siri, turn the lights on almost.
Oh, my God, I feel like I'm in George Jetson land.
Yeah, I mean, out of that long list, you know, the continual iteration of the iPhone, the 4S, I mean, people thought it was a bit of a damp squib,
yeah.
but it turned out to be, like, extremely successful.
Charles, we played around with Siri in the studio. Mike says that it was quite amusing. Mike says that that's the standout for him this year. What's your reaction to Siri? Do you think it will revolutionize?
It's really interesting, and it's one of those things where it can only get better. You know, the thing about voice recognition is that it needs lots of voice recognition data, and then it can improve.
Well, kind of like the Palm Pilot back in the day, where you had to use the handwriting and it had to recognize your handwriting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or the iBo.
Well, yeah. I mean, Siri is about more than just voice recognition. It's more than just you said this. It's about understanding what you're saying and the intentionality of what you're saying. And that goes quite a bit beyond just plain voice recognition. And there's a sort of danger that we parse it all in the same way. And so Microsoft said, oh, we've had voice recognition on Windows Phone for years. No one's bothered, you know, looking at it. It's like, well, one thing, you didn't advertise it, and second, you know, who had a Windows Phone? And Google's was sort of a bit similar. So Andy Rubin said, oh, come on, you know, we've got voice recognition. But that's not the same as natural language control. And, you know, one can see enormous potential for Siri, but I think that this is going to be a classic case where people's imaginations of what Apple will do run miles ahead of what Apple actually will do. Apple is a very careful company. It moves very slowly with these things. So, you know, when the iPod first came out, people said, I know what it's going to be. It's going to be a wireless controller, which will take everything around your house, and it will also play music, and it will be a TV controller as well. It was like, no, it just holds some music.
In a sense, that's exactly what happened with the predictions for the 4S. They thought that would be the iPhone 5 and it would, you know, do the dishes as well as everything else. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's very gradual iteration of these products that makes them even better.
Well, the gradual iteration of the iPad has been interesting because, you know, the iPad 2, slimmer, sexier, you know, all of the lovely tactile haptic things that you get from this particular Apple product.
The magnetic cover.
Yeah, very. I mean, they definitely know how to do the detail, but have these details simply swept the market, Charles? Are there any competitors out there for the iPad?
Some unofficial statistics from an analyst company that many people will have heard of, but which I can't name, suggests that the iPad had 77% of the world market for tablets in the third quarter. And I suspect that's going to be even bigger in the fourth quarter. The most interesting thing as well is that in the past week or so, Microsoft has started offering a whole lot of apps for the iPad. Xbox Live, SkyDrive, which is its cloud storage service, and OneNote, which was its thing for the tablet. And that's really interesting because Microsoft's a software company. Why would they be doing this? Why would they be potentially killing off sales of their Windows 8 tablets? I think that they're trying to get a feel for how tablets will work so they can be in an even better position. But it helps Apple as well.
Well, we'll come back to the iPad and other tablets and some of Apple's other systems a bit later in the program. Well, 2011 wasn't a great year for some other big names in tech. Step Forward, RIM, Nokia, and HP. The fortunes of all three companies have been affected by Apple and Google's entry into the mobile market. And in February, Stephen Elop, the then newly appointed CEO of Nokia, mailed the company to say, "We are standing on a burning platform and must decide how to change our behavior." In April, Nokia linked up with Microsoft to make the Windows Phone OS its primary operating system. And it's just recently seen the first devices launched with the Nokia Lumia going on sale. Mike, why Microsoft? Why not Android, WebOS, or something else?
Well, they had to make a choice. Nokia was caught between a rock and a hard place. They saw Android coming up, and they didn't obviously want to get into the Google ecosystem. They obviously Apple wasn't a choice. Nokia ended up with three different platforms that they were working on. I mean, and these teams weren't even talking to each other. It was unbelievable when you sort of opened the hood and found the sort of spaghetti junction inside of what Nokia was coming up with. And Stephen Elop, I think probably quite rightly, had to make a choice. And Windows quite clearly wanted to, you know, Microsoft wanted to get into the game. Lots and lots of cash available.
And Charles, Elop's past was at Microsoft, so was this relationship inevitable?
It wasn't, no. He did look seriously at Android, and he did get wooed by Steve Ballmer, but I think he was keeping Microsoft very thoroughly at arm's length in that sense. My understanding is that Ballmer sort of intimated to him that there were going to be some lawsuits coming against Android handset makers, and that if Nokia was to go with Android, could be, you know, that there'd be a big lawsuit in the way.
He was right in that sense, given what Samsung and Apple have done.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But also, that Microsoft has extracted per license fees from HTC and from Samsung for the fact that they make Android handsets, which Microsoft says infringe on patents that it owns. So that wasn't going to be good for Nokia if it went with Android. And there was also the question of, well, will it get favored? Would it get early access to code in the way that, say, Samsung does for the Nexus models versus Microsoft, which was going to put a lot of money into Windows Phone, like literally billions of dollars of marketing. It all added up to good news for Elop.
But their market share dipped below 30% for the first time. So handling the transition...
It was going there anyway. Symbian was dead even before he called it dead.
All the growth in the market, a lot of the growth in the market was coming out of the smartphone end of the market. Nokia has still a huge legacy of handsets with its old Symbian operating system, especially in emerging economies. But, you know, that just wasn't going anywhere. I mean, if you talk to a developer, trying to develop Symbian apps was really much tougher than everyone else. So that was where they had to head, towards the upper end of the market.
Well, speaking of the operating system, Windows Phone went to 7.5, to Mango.
If I speak to colleagues in the tech industry who are trying out the Windows phones, they're sort of pleasantly surprised since the latest one's coming out.
They're amazed it's not as bad as Windows Mobile.
It's
not actually as bad as cutting off my leg. This is all right. I can live with it. I have to say my own experience is I've used Android, I've used iOS extensively, and I've used Windows Phone a year ago, and I used it as Mango. And the thing I found with Mango was that there were just basic things that couldn't be done where you thought you could do them. And there were ways in which it seemed to lead you astray in what it was promising. You know, there are things about it I liked, and I think the Lumia is a nice handset, but I think there's basic usability questions still over.
Absolutely. They've still got some boxes to tick on the interface.
Moving on to BlackBerry, RIM has had a terrible year. We've covered them extensively here on the podcast, all because of service outages and a little thing called the BlackBerry Playbook tablet. Charles, how has the Playbook shaped RIM's year?
It's turned it into a really, really crap one rather than just a bad one. The Playbook, I think, has cost them about $1 billion in terms of the money that they put into it, the inventory that they had to take. They've taken a $485 million write-off in their latest results. They've managed to ship, rather than the 2 million that I think they were hoping to ship, they've managed to ship, from memory, 750,000. That's not the same
seven.
As sold. That's cost a lot of cash. You know, I was looking at their cash and short-term equivalents in their balance sheets, and that's dropped by about 800 million in the past year or so, and that's something almost entirely attributable to the playbook.
We would be very, very interested in hearing from somebody who has a playbook, just to talk through what their experience is with it. Because, Mike, why was it so bad? Why did it go so wrong?
Oh, I tried one myself, and it was just sort of incredibly frustrating. It's just, how do I play this video? How do I switch the thing on? How do I get it? I mean, it was just weird. But there are some great, you know, some really happy 17-year-olds out there who queued up outside Best Buy in the US and, you know, got something to play some videos on and stuff like that, you know, for a price of $50 or so.
Charles, what do you think they're going to have to do to get out of the hole that they're in? They can't really rely on BBM. They can't rely on the BlackBerry, can they? She said
they
can't.
The problem is that their latest forecast for their coming quarter, which covers December, which is, you know, Christmas, they're suggesting they'll sell between it's something around 14 million. No, wait a minute. It's 11 to 12 million phones, and that compares to 14 in the year before quarter. So they're expecting to sell fewer phones than a year ago in a smartphone market which is expanding. That's not good. And that's also not good because this is with a line of new phones which were meant to be reviving the platform on the BB7 OS before they come to the QNX-based phones, which is going to be called BBX.
And this is after some pretty good PR as well this summer surrounding the riots.
Brilliant, brilliant PR.
Really, yeah. Incredible.
40% of teenagers in the UK own a BlackBerry, and the lines were running hot.
I think
during the summer.
But the
BlackBerry went down as well.
The network went down.
In fact, almost as seriously, bankers in the city couldn't get their email for about a week. Goodness me.
How much of an effect do you think that had, Mike, on their fortune?
Anecdotally, people were switching all over the place to iPhone and God knows what else. Weirdly, though, I mean, so much value is wrapped up in BlackBerry's messaging service. And in a way, you can almost see a future for the company becoming almost a software company to all smartphone platforms. Mm. But the fact that it went down for an entire week, it's almost like the whole thing is running off about four computers across the whole world. And, you know, of course the thing was going to go down. It's crazy.
They're sort of eating humble pie as far as they can. So Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis have said that they're going to only take a dollar in pay for the coming year, the coming financial year, for which John Gruber said, dollar too much.
Ooh, handbags. Ouch. Well, finally, in the bad news section, HP. This year, they've had two CEOs who flip-flopped over some big decisions. In August, Leo Apotheker pulled the company out of PC production and ended plans for new tablets and mobiles following their purchase of Palm in 2010. But in a big U-turn, the new CEO, Meg Whitman, announced in October that the company would continue to manufacture PCs and tablets, though they were to dump the web OS platform and concentrate only on Windows 8 for tablets. Mike, what was the thinking behind getting out of the PC market?
Well, if you see that, I mean, historically, there's been a flight away from hardware has just become, you know, hugely commoditized. It's interesting now to see hardware manufacturers actually starting to stop making netbooks. I mean, netbooks were supposed to be the next big thing, weren't they, a couple of years ago? And actually, hardware makers just go, you know what, let's just, like, make really good laptops that, you know, because they're becoming cheap again.
And smaller and lighter.
Exactly. And, let's just follow the MacBook Air, in fact, which is going to be an absolute gangbuster of a product for Apple next year, the MacBook Air. There's obviously still life left in the PC, of course there is, but it's coming up with the kind of a magic formula, really. They've got to look at it.
Charles, what effect did the decision have on the former CEO, Apotheker? I mean, did this decision lead to his departure?
It was one of them. It was the fact that Wall Street couldn't quite get hold of what he was saying was a big problem. And the fact that HP's results leaked, I think, twice in a row ahead of what they should have, which always gets you in big trouble with the SEC. The fact that he wasn't communicating well with the people inside HP. The fact that actually not all of the board had met him before they appointed him. You know, the board is in HP sort of redefines dysfunctional. But at least they knew Whitman because she'd been on the board for ages. So, you know, she can't entirely escape the blame for what had gone before. You know, she can take some of the credit if things start to go right. But, you know, actually, HP as a company, you know, rather as as happened with Sony, and as some people suspect could happen with Apple. It's a company where the legacy is no longer driving the company. A lot of short-term confusion and lack of vision is what's going on. So I spoke to some executives at HP at Mobile World Congress earlier in the year, and I said, okay, so how are you going to, there's a lot of tablets being announced out here. There's lots of Android tablets. There's the iPad. There's RIM. How are you going to make a difference with the touchpad? And the suggestion was, well, corporates. I said, okay, so you're also going to be selling a smartphone. How are you going to make that, given that the carriers had a bad time with the Palm Pre when you were selling that, how are you going to get that into shops? And it was, no really good answer there. They just didn't have the relationship with the carriers that you need to have. So the death of the smartphone, of the HP Pre smartphone, not surprising. The death of the touchpad, more surprising. But I think that's because the board is just all over the place.
Well, it's interesting that ex-board member, current CEO Meg Whitman, made the U-turn and has reinstated the development of PCs, given what you were saying, Mike, about the death of the PC. Who's right? Is Leo or Meg? Who do you put your money behind?
Well, I think, of course, even though it is a legacy business, it's still, there's still plenty of money in that market. And also coming up with, it's interesting how people are kind of copying the Apple strategy in terms of form factor. And also the tablet market is going to be huge next year. It would be crazy to get out of tablets right now.
Which is why they've got out of it.
Yeah, which is odd, isn't it?
Crazy. But I think the thing for HP
Well, they're using Windows now, though.
Well, yeah, but, sure.
Okay,
but I think the thing for HP is that they're retaining the PCs because they've got synergies, really, with other things that they do, like services. So it works well for them to be able to sell services and have a PC contract.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what 2012 brings for all three of these companies. Okay, next, the year in Google. This year, the search company branched out even further and had another attempt at creating a social network, Google+. CEO Eric Schmidt became executive chairman Eric Schmidt in January and later owned up that he had, and I quote, screwed up on social networking while he was in charge. The company also closed down a number of products like Google Buzz to focus on Google+ too. Now in mobile, it's been a mixed year for the big G. The Galaxy Nexus launched, premiering their new operating system, Ice Cream Sandwich, and they laid down cash to purchase mobile company Motorola, which seemed to unsettle their partners in Android, but looked more like a land grab for patents after losing a battle for Nortel's intellectual property in a rather embarrassing fashion. Android tablets continued to underwhelm in 2011. The advancement of Android tablets has hardly been helped by a distracting battle between Apple and Samsung over copying each other's devices too. Mike, looking back, has 2011 been a good year for Google?
It'll be a little bit like when Microsoft turned the ship around towards the internet, suddenly realized that the internet was going to be a big deal. Because Google's future is definitely going to be wrapped up in social. That's absolutely key to what it's doing, leaving aside the Android issue, etc. And social is going to be massive because, the juggernaut that is Facebook is coming up, in the rearview mirror. It's now going to make $1 billion this year. And social is going to be a massive search market. Facebook is going to be the next Google, I'm convinced of it. And Google has to get into social to make its search results better. This is going to be the year where everyone thought Google, they went for it.
It's interesting, actually, this notion of going social. It's not just about creating a social networking platform, which is actually very much a kind of retrospective, a retroactive system. It's just sort of building social into all of your services. It doesn't
Absolutely.
Matter what it is. It's a component.
And it's a component. It's a key component because it makes advertising better. And the more they know about you, the better the ads get targeted and the more money they make. Basically, it comes down to that, I'm afraid.
Where's the social element in that, though? I mean, I sort of, I hear what you're saying, that Facebook is big. I completely agree. But, Google's money is in doing searches and delivering ads which are targeted to your searches. Why do you think the social element of that actually matters any?
To put it simply, they know what you were doing yesterday as opposed to searching. They know what you were thinking about, where you were, certainly if you're declaring your location, and that becomes a heuristic data that can be much more greatly targeted.
They can kind of extrapolate using a data-driven algorithm to produce something that they believe is going to be relevant and valuable to you.
And it's all key to the Android strategy as well. You have to have a Gmail address, right?
So, Larry Page, Charles, stepping up to the mic. Have there been any big changes? Anything that wasn't put into place before Schmidt stepped down?
He's really looking to trim the fat, and he got all the product managers, the people in charge of teams and projects, to explain what the hell they were doing and why they were doing it. And I think that you'll find that he's actually been cutting back more than starting up, certainly in his first sort of 12 months or so. That's really what he's trying to do. He's trying to bring better focus back. One of the things he said at Google Zeitgeist was that you don't see any companies which make good slow decisions. You've got to make good fast decisions, and that's really what he's into, is making decisions quickly and making the right ones.
Well, what we've also seen this year is the rise of the patent battle and Google's involvement in that. To what extent do you think Page has been instrumental in going for that land grab? Or was this just simply something that made good business sense, regardless of who was at the helm?
No, I think that they completely see the need to defend Android and to defend the Google Android handset makers. I'm sort of calling the Google Android to distinguish them from Amazon, which has forked off the Android code base. And the Kindle Fire doesn't require you to log into Google. It very explicitly doesn't. It's very much about Amazon there. And the Kindle Fire is interesting because that splits the Android, the tablet market, into non-Google and Google Android tablets. And actually, the Kindle Fire is going to chew up a hell of a lot. So, you know, when the numbers come in, I suspect you'll see Apple iPad, Amazon Kindle Fire, and then all the rest. Yeah, and that'll be a small part of that.
Of course, it's interesting to realize that when you're talking about Android, you're not just talking about the phones. I think most people would stop at the phones and not extend that to
the
tablet.
That's true. The phones thing is important. You know, in China, there's lots of Android manufacturers who, again, I think are not referencing Google. They're just using the code, and then they're building their own smartphone handsets. And in some cases, they're putting different search engines on than Google, which ain't great news for Google.
Mike, speaking of the patent battle, how did Google come out in the end when it all shook down?
Well, it bought Motorola, which, even though it was embarrassing, it couldn't get the Nortel, but it got Motorola. And also it sort of put people at rest in terms of how it was strategy going forward with Motorola. The patent battle, really, it's ongoing. It is. And I mean, it's the weird thing is how Apple is, Apple and Samsung and Google, etc., facing off in various different territories. They're having great fun in places like Germany and trying to stop sales of each other's products effectively in these kinds of often like major European markets.
There's sort of Damoclean swords everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, Google also announced next year that it will open up offices in the East End of London, which leads to our next subject for discussion. Tech City, the government's initiative to foster an innovative digital community in the East End of London, also known as a cash cow that will ascend the country from this recession. Tech City made its mark in 2011. Celebrating the first anniversary of its inception in November, Tech City appointed an ambassador, was given a greater push by government, and at last count, Mike, I think there are at least 500 tech companies, if not more. I heard a number the other day, 800.
Is that including dry cleaners? Yeah.
I think they have internet access in the back.
I think it would be fair to say that there has been a little bit of Tech City inflation. I say that even as somebody who's quite upbeat about the whole thing. I mean, in a way, look back. A couple of years ago, the people who were being entertained at Number 10 were very, very large technology companies, you know, Microsoft, you know, Apple, etc. And suddenly now we have entrepreneurs, technology entrepreneurs.
We have Cool Britannia for the geeks.
Cool Britannia. It's Tech Britannia.
It's just
But it's, in a way, you know, it's no bad thing that these guys are being recognised. But, you know, let's calm down on the numbers thing. But the interesting thing, though, is that there was organic growth in the East End of London. That's quite clear. Independent bodies like DoDill, who are taking company database, have found that there is a cluster there. We can argue about the numbers till the cows come home, but the growth is there. And in a sense, the government was right to shine a light and double down on the growth there and try and, in fact, kind of enliven the whole country about the fact that you can go and start a technology company if you really want to.
And I definitely think that PR angle has been enormously powerful, because technology and digital is, Charles, something that will certainly governments around the world are putting their weight behind. They think that this is the thing that's going to get us out of this global recession. So to that extent, do you think the Tech City has been a success?
Well, yeah. I mean, the great thing about software in particular is that it's weightless. You know, so you don't need a manufacturing base. You don't need to have heavy lifting and factories and giant warehouses to do it. You can have converted lofts, and you can do it up and down the country. So in that sense, it's completely portable. But it's, at the same time, you can generate great value with it. So yeah, it's absolutely what the government should want.
Mike, one of the problems, though, with a tech city is that by shining the light on that particular area, the reason why the cluster had started to emerge is because rents were low. It was a good space where creatives and geeks could get together, lovies and boffins, to coin a phrase, could get together and create some interesting products. And the rent was cheap. But now, of course, with so much attention on Tech City, on East London, on the legacy of the Olympics, it's, you're getting Louis Vuitton opening little boutique shops in Tower Hamlets. You're getting the big players coming in and saying, oh, well, Shoreditch, it's the place to be.
Lots of gurus talking about the Silicon Valley cluster, Paul Graham, Y Combinator, various other people have always said that it's a good idea to cluster, especially when you're talking about software development, because this is the way new ideas bubble up. Bumping into somebody in a coffee shop and having a conversation about what you're working on, things happen. But there is going to be a natural gentrification of that whole area. The city is generally moving, the square mile, as it were, is generally moving northwards, as it, it recovers effectively. Everyone, the geeks will move on. They'll move to, other parts of London and what have you.
Will they move to places like Cambridge or some of the other places that have had lights not shown on them?
Cambridge isn't cheap.
Absolutely. But some of the other clusters, some of the other technology clusters around
Cambridge
the country.
Cambridge has had a light shone on it for years as a biotech centre, as a technology hub arm, etc.
But are places like Edinburgh losing out because of the focus on this?
No, I don't think so. I think that probably, apart from anything else, we can't expect the Tech City project to deliver anything in a year, for heaven's sake. But moving forward, I think we'll see the government and others start to say, we've shone a light, we've talked about entrepreneurs, we've talked about startups, let's get the whole country moving. And it's very interesting to see the latest government policy to double down on getting high-speed broadband into particular urban conurbations, about six cities in the UK. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be money available for that. And I don't know, we'll see how it plays out next year.
Well, it wasn't just Tech City that the government has been involved in this year, Charles. I'd love to hear from you what's happened as we've been focused on Tech City. We've in some ways forgotten about the Digital Economy Act. What happened this year?
Basically, it's sort of been sitting there parked in a siding for pretty much the whole year. There's been lots more discussion about three strikes. There's been judicial reviews which have come and gone and found that the government was okay to go ahead as it was. The whole issue of would people get cut off, what sort of actions would be taken, has all moved incredibly slowly. And possibly the only thing that's moved any slower has been the 4G auction.
There was lots of talk, wasn't there, about people being cut off and the internet being throttled and things like that. But those stories didn't really appear nearly as much this year.
Yeah, we didn't get much about people looting music, did we?
No. But on the other side of the fence was the Hargreaves report into copyright came from sort of the other end of the spectrum, sort of trying to loosen up, actually, the UK's legislation around these issues. And actually that was quite well received, especially amongst the technology community, who sort of slightly breathed a sigh of relief, saying, "Oh my God, somebody's actually talking a certain amount of sense about fair use issues, etc."
Charles, you are an open data man. From your perspective, can you give us a report card on open data this year?
Generally, there is a big push. It's very hard to see from outside, but actually there's a big groundswell. There's, as I think is possibly the easiest way to describe it, a tectonic shift going on there, which has been driven by Francis Maude. He's the lead minister on this, and he is actually making things happen. You know, some people don't like Francis Maude because they think that he's sort of old school and, sort of dyed-in-the-wool conservative. But the thing about him is that he's a real operator. He is so incredibly skilled as a politician that anyone who tries to get round him discovers that he is everywhere blocking them off. And when he wants to get something done, it will get done.
Well, a relatively glowing report card then for the government and its digital technology initiatives. You can listen to our extensive coverage of Tech City, including the three special live Tech Weekly events, the Tech City Talks, on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Well, it's also been a big year in games. And here is our games correspondent, Keith Stewart, with the lowdown.
I think the first big event of the year was the launch of the Nintendo 3DS handheld console in March.
This is the new Nintendo 3DS. Discover an amazing world of 3D without the need for glasses.
Lots of people, including me, thought this was going to be another really big successful Nintendo release, but it didn't turn out quite like that. It shifted fewer units than everyone really thought, and there were lots of worries at the time about the stereoscopic visuals and how they made some users sick, and the Sun newspaper ran a big story on the subject and got lots of people concerned about it. I think a bigger problem, though, was the lack of big first-party games. There was no Mario title with it, there was no Zelda, there was nothing really to get the fans excited, and I don't think the reasonably high price point helped either. A few months down the line, Nintendo admitted that it hadn't been the best launch ever. It dropped the price of the console and it had this amazing idea of actually releasing some good games for it. So now we've got the likes of Super Mario 3D Land, we've got Mario Kart 7, we've got Cave Story 3D, we've got Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, and we've actually got a really good downloadable title called Pool Blocks. And there are some really good, exciting titles lined up for next year. So I think maybe in the end what it needed was some really good games, which shouldn't have really have come as a surprise to anyone. Another key problem with the 3DS is the rise of smartphones, iPhone and the Android devices.
If you don't have an iPhone, you don't have the largest selection of games on any phone.
The people maybe who a few years ago would have bought a Nintendo DS to play things like brain training games and pet games can now get those games for 69p on their iPhone or on their Galaxy phone, so they don't really need a dedicated handheld console, and I think that's a problem which really isn't really going to go away for Nintendo.
Yep. If you don't have an iPhone, well, you don't have an iPhone.
I think the second big story of the year really was the hacking of the PlayStation Network. In April, an unknown hacker group broke into the back-end servers of Sony's online gaming service and potentially got access to the credit card details and names of millions of PlayStation gamers. The service was shut down for several weeks and Sony tried to introduce new security measures, and it does all seem to be working now. But I think the problem with it was lots and lots of gamers were cross at Sony for not announcing that they had a problem sooner. I think it took maybe 6 days before Sony admitted that the servers had been hacked. Sony had reasonably good reasons for this, but it ask questions really about how we can trust these companies going forwards. I think this is a key issue about our age of digital gaming and downloadable content. How much can we really trust the likes of Microsoft and Sony and Activision to look after our data? And I don't mean just our personal details and our bank details, but also our game progress. Microsoft has just launched cloud-based game saves for the Xbox 360. Which sounds really convenient and, you know, a nice way of keeping all your game progress up on the internet and not clogging up your hard drive. But, you know, what happens if a server somewhere goes down and takes your 60-hour Elder Scrolls save with it?
At 6:22, attacks were triggered across Europe. Targets were key military and intelligence organizations.
My third big story really was the most recent, and that was the success of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3.
Let's do this!
Okay, game on.
The game was released on November the 8th, and within 16 days it made $1 billion in revenue for Activision and for stores. And that got to the 1 billion mark before big movies like Avatar and Harry Potter. Lots of people are now saying that this really represents the emergence of video games as a mainstream entertainment form. But I think in some ways the success of this game masks the state of the wider games industry, which, like the movie business, now relies very heavily on massive AAA titles having massive opening weekends and making massive amounts of cash to recoup the massive development costs. There's no real room anymore for sleeper hits or modest successes in the mainstream industry. I think that's been hard for a lot of publishers. I think the likes of THQ, Capcom and Sega have all really struggled this year. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if we see a major publisher collapsing in 2012, because the market is just so difficult to release a big game in this marketplace.
Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3, rated M for mature.
My final story is really more of a trend, an ongoing trend, than a single news event. And that's the rise of social gaming, which generally means games that run on social networks like Facebook. Last year, in 2010, it was all about Zynga and Farmville and how enormous that was. But I think the concept has evolved considerably in 2011. Through the year, we had the rise of much more complex, in-depth multiplayer titles like Kabam's Kingdoms of Camelot and The Godfather. So games running on Facebook are now becoming much more like, I guess, traditional games in that they're more challenging and they're more competitive. But what we're also seeing at the same time is features from social games creeping into traditional console games. So, for example, EA's Need for Speed titles all have what they call the auto-log feature, which lets gamers easily find their friends and challenge each other and compare scores. In the past, playing multiplayer games on console, you were often playing against strangers in public servers, and you ended up having to shoot or be shot by, usually, lots of 12-year-old Texans. But now it's much more easy to find the people you actually want to play against and to find your friends. As for 2012, I think there's a few big things to look out for. The PlayStation Vita is coming in February, and this is a new handheld console from Sony. It has a 5-inch screen, a lovely, really crisp, detailed screen, two analog sticks, and a touchpad on the back and on the front. So it's going to give rise to some quite interesting, innovative, tactile games, I think. But the key problem with it is, again, like the Nintendo 3DS, is this rise of smartphones. In 2012, we're going to see several manufacturers releasing handsets with quad-core processors and very high-end graphics chips. And this is the same sort of architecture as the PlayStation Vita. So you've really got to wonder if smartphone games are doing everything that Vita can, plus allowing us to phone people, can there ever really be room in the market for another dedicated handheld console? PlayStation Vita. Launching later in the year, we're going to have the Wii U, which is a sort of souped-up version of the Wii with more powerful processing. But the key new thing is this tablet-style controller, which the console comes with, which has its own screen, and it lets you view elements of the game on your own private display. Obviously, this will work really well for multiplayer games when you're all sitting around in the living room playing against your friends. You'll be able to see maybe aspects of the game world on your screen that your friends can't see, which is quite a nice idea. But I also wonder maybe if Nintendo is working on deals with TV companies so that they can support maybe certain television programs with Wii U features. So say, what if the next series of X Factor had Wii U support so you could vote and comment on the acts on your tablet as you watched? Finally, the big news story, or it could be the big non-news story of 2012, is going to be the release of Grand Theft Auto 5.
Why did I move here? I guess it was the weather. Or the... I don't know, that thing. That magic.
Rockstar's latest big crime adventure hasn't actually been confirmed for 2012, so it could not happen. But if it does happen, it's definitely going to be the biggest major AAA release of the year. If only because Rockstar, unlike Activision, unlike EA, hasn't turned Grand Theft Auto into this kind of annual grinding franchise. They still spend 3 or 4 years on each title, really perfecting it and moulding it. I think it's going to be really interesting to see where Grand Theft Auto goes in this iteration. One last thing I would say is watch out for the E3 Video Games Exhibition in June. I think that either Microsoft or Sony, or possibly both, will have very, very big announcements this year.
Okay, before we go, a look ahead to the treats and trends we're expecting next year. Let's go through some of the themes and start off with Charles, 3D TV.
I think 3D TV won't do as well as smart TV, but I don't think either of them is going to do particularly well because people aren't going to be buying TVs that much. I think that the general replacement rate is about, on average, is about 20% of installed TVs. But economic situation, bit slow. People are looking to hang on to them. And also something like 80%, I think, of people bought a TV in the past 5 years.
But what about the digital switchover? I mean, next year it's done. So those people who still have the analog, the cathode ray tubes, you know, those machines aren't going to be, they're not going to be fit for purpose anymore.
Yeah. The people who've still got analog TVs, if they buy a new TV, which they might, or they might buy a set-top box, they're probably not going to be watching smart TV or 3D TV. But if they're the sort of digital, you know, digital holdouts, they're not going to be the digital early adopters.
But it's not just the hardware. There's also, you know, some really interesting services that we can look forward to. Apple TV, Google TV,
but then
Netflix coming to the UK.
Exactly, but it's an issue of those devices being plugged into your existing TV. And in fact, people are looking at their consoles and going, well, you know, actually, I can get a BBC iPlayer on my Wii, Nintendo Wii or whatever it is. So, The actual TV is less of an issue now.
Charles, when you do look at some of the services that are coming apparently from left field, when you look at the old players who, you know, are traditional broadcast medium, now we do have things like Google and Apple getting into the mix. What do you see happening over the next 12 months?
I don't think that they're going to get a lot of traction because the thing about Google TV is it's very ad-driven and it needs to get the partners. The thing about Apple TV is it's basically, as we understand it at the moment anyway, is that it's basically a way for Apple to sell you stuff off the Apple Store, rather than being a sort of a conduit for existing channels. There's already loads of ways that you can get this stuff. You can, you know, you can get it on Freeview or Freeview HD. You can get it with Sky if you're a Sky subscriber. You can get it through your console. So, you know, Microsoft Xbox has got a big push here. You can get it on your Wii. The PS3, I think, does this as well. There's a whole panoply of them. And then you have the added complication, which is, okay, so I want to do smart TV, or I want to do TV over the internet. Okay, so how fast is your broadband? How big is the cap on your broadband? You know, this stuff all takes, you know, data, and it has to be data which is being delivered pretty quickly, or else the picture is going to be rubbish, and you're going to bust your cap on your broadband. So for a lot of people, I think that the good old over-the-air version is going to be better.
Mike, looking at hardware, you mentioned this year was going to be the year for MacBook Air. Why? Versus, you know, any other Ultrabooks that are out there to compete with it.
I think they've nailed the product down now. The latest updates to the MacBook Air have been really just created great devices. They've basically got the design now, and next year is going to be, it'll be iterations again, as Apple always does, and the price will, you know, become affordable again as well. And, you know, and obviously with the Mac App Store as well, it's a Trojan horse effectively for Apple services. And of course, the launch of the iCloud and other kinds of services that Apple is really trying to push now, cloud services, this is their way of getting people involved in their whole ecosystem.
Going back to what Mike was saying about the MacBook Air, all the PC makers are trying to do this new class of device called the Ultrabook, which is basically, yeah, let's make one that looks like the MacBook Air. And they're trying to price it at the same sort of price, which they're managing sort of to do with the help of about $100 per device that they're getting from Intel. because Intel wants to push this category, given that netbooks are dying. Interesting that Intel is saying that it's going to be about $1 billion off its forecasts for this quarter because of the hard drive shortage. It'll be interesting to see whether the hard drive shortage caused by the floods in Thailand, whether that drives perhaps a move to solid-state drives, because I think that could be an interesting trend next year. They're now reaching the price where everyone should really be able to swap them in to get the benefit of the speed that you get with them.
Beyond hardware, we've got some big events that are happening next year, some really big events that are happening next year, not just in the UK, but globally. Mike, what do you think the effect is going to be on technology of the Olympics?
Well, I think we're going to see lots and lots of people trying to stream video of and you know, of over their smartphone of the 100-meter sprint,
zoom
effectively.
In, zoom in on the beach volleyball.
3G yes. networks going down. In fact, although they're trying to put Wi-Fi all over the Olympic Park in London, so to effectively to try and sort of, you know, dampen down that demand.
It might be interesting, you know, if they run out of IP addresses. If they're still doing things on IPv4 and then IPv6, that'll get interesting.
I think it's a lot of it's about just ordinary people coming up with content that they'll be. I mean, you'll be able to sort of see what the results are on Twitter, and nobody has to pay for that data effectively. And the whole sort of locked up issue around licensing of data around the Olympics, for instance, is really going to be probably exploded.
I think that's going to be a real. There's going to be a big fight there about what can you do with pictures from the Olympics, videos from the Olympics,
absolutely.
Results from the Olympics,
whether it's
information,
be global, whether it's
can you take
local.
A picture and send it out of the stadium, you know, can you bring your own food in, all these, you know, this is going to actually be a real flashpoint, I think.
Another element, Charles, of where people are expecting money to go flying is with the domain changes, .amazon, .coke, .google, .everything and their uncle.
What .apple. Do we,
.apple. What do you expect coming out of that?
That's going to be really interesting. You'll get a picture of which companies are making a bet on the web and, you know, really putting their money down for that. And I suspect that, yeah, you'll have .amazon. All those big names will have put their name down and they'll be owning their own top-level domain, which they'll be using for all sorts of things. You know, you buy a device, you log in, you have your own .microsoft address, you know. And that fits in as well with IPv6, which I think is going to be, you know, coming over the horizon next year, where devices can start to have their own IP address, you know, which is unique and which lasts forever.
What effect will that have on me as a human being, a customer, a device owner?
If everything in your house or your office or all the things you need are independently addressable on the internet at any time, then the characteristic of how you think about finding those things, connecting with those things, changes in a really subtle way. So it's rather like, you know, you get a glimpse of it when you think, oh, I'm abroad. How do I get at my documents? Oh, they're all in the cloud. That's fine. I can get them by logging in. Now think about that applied to things in your office, things in your home, things in your, maybe even your car or, you know, whatever you use to get around on. When you start to be able to get that information at any time, then how you think about what you do changes, but in a really subtle way.
Well, that is it for the roundup of 2011 and our peek into 2012. Thank you very much for listening to this extended program this year. And don't forget that they're all still there in the archive to listen back to if you've missed any of them. Thanks to Charles and to Mike for coming in today. Season's greetings, gentlemen. And thank you to everyone who's taken part in the program this year. In particular, our team member, Jemima Kish, who's lost in motherhood somewhere right now. We hope she'll be back with us before 2012 is out. Yeah, with multiple babies in tow. The producer this week was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratowski. See you next year.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.